Wake up, everyone. It's time for a call to action. Welcome to Call to Action Today, where there are no sacred cows, with your host, Steve Noble, just an ordinary man who believes in an extraordinary God, and he's calling you out every week to live the Christian life in your home, your work, and even in politics. Call Steve now at 866-34-TRUTH, or check him out online at c2atoday.org. And now, with some much-needed cough medicine for the church, here's your host, Steve Noble.
I'd be willing to bet some serious money if I were a betting man. I would be willing to bet some serious money that you are holding on to some ideas, some presuppositions, some notions, some thoughts, some ways of looking at life, and perhaps even ways of looking at Christianity that are, well, nothing short of idolatrous, or nothing short of false, or nothing short of possibly even secular, and maybe even atheistic, and maybe even postmodern, and that could be you, one or some combination of all of those things today on Call to Action Radio. Of course, it is Theology Thursday live from the campus of Southeastern Baptist Theological Seminary, and we're going to be talking today about something that normally people never talk about, this subject outside of the world of the academy and academia, something called the history of ideas. Now, that's not every idea that every Tom, Dick, and Harry has ever had since the beginning of time, but these are major ideas and ways of thinking and looking at the world, philosophies, if you'd like to throw that word in there, that have ebbed and flowed throughout human history, and much to many people's surprise today, may be firmly lodged in the way that you're living your life, and you don't even know it. So if this is important enough to teach not only college students, but also master's level students and PhD students and people getting their doctorate, which is a PhD, then it should be good enough for the rest of us. So today, a friend that's been on the show before, Amber Bowen, she's here at Southeastern Baptist Theological Seminary, as well as teaching at the college at Southeastern. And people go, well, there's a college there? Yes, as a matter of fact, there is. We'll talk about that too. Amber Bowen, welcome back to Call to Action. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks.
So tell us a little bit about how you ended up here at Southeastern, because you're not only teaching at the college at Southeastern, but you're also a student working on your master's in philosophy. Is that what you're working on?
Philosophy of religion.
So working on your master's in philosophy of religion. But how did you end up here at the great place that we are, Southeastern Baptist Theological Seminary?
Well, I ended up here many, many years ago. I was a 17-year-old, just finished high school, graduated, couldn't wait to start college, had to take a summer class that summer just not to waste any time. And so I showed up on this campus in 2004 as a 17-year-old, just graduated high school, and started with my first philosophy class here. And I ended up absolutely loving my experience here and loving studying the history of ideas, and just really thrived here. And then immediately after I graduated, I moved to Milan, Italy as a journeyman for 2 years. And I was really interested, especially coming out of the History of Ideas
program. What's a journeyman?
A journeyman is a missionary with the International Missions Board.
Got it.
It's a 2-year term. And I wanted to go to Western Europe because of my study of the history of ideas and learning a lot about secularism and postmodernity and things like that, that I really wanted to engage that people group. So I went, and it was a very formative experience for me, and I ended up actually staying an additional 2 years and just got a job teaching history and philosophy at an Italian school. Moved back here and started a master's in philosophy of religion here, and I'm in my last year there and plan to teach or pursue PhD afterwards. But this, just because my life has come full circle, I now find myself this semester teaching my very first History of Ideas class. In fact, fun fact, in the exact same classroom that I took my very first class.
Wow, that's pretty cool.
Way back in 2004.
A little serendipity there. That's
yes.
Excellent. Well, most people think that philosophy and the history of ideas and something that we talk about in the halls of higher education, and they wonder, what does that have to do with me? And obviously, you went and spent that time in Italy, and you're out there not just in the classroom, but just living life daily in the streets of Italy, wherever you were living at the time. Mm-hmm. But what does it have to do with kind of people outside of, well, a campus like Southeastern?
Well, one of the things that struck me when I moved from the classroom to the streets of Italy and to another culture was the History of Ideas program very much helped equip me to be able to understand how a culture works. We understand how a culture grows, how a culture moves, how it thinks, the things that are underneath the culture. So I think it really helped me actually to be able to assimilate very well into that culture, because it gave me an eye for it. At the same time, I was able to engage with living, breathing people who were asking questions and thinking things and coming from a heritage of different ideologies or schools of thought, and being able to see that live, not yeah. just in the classroom or in a textbook, but be able to see living products of that. And then, you know what? When I came back to America, I realized that it functions the exact same way here, that we are products of the same thing. We have ideas that shape and mold our culture. And sometimes, you know how they say it takes you stepping out of your culture in order for you to actually be able to look back and see it? And so I think coming back to the States and being able to see it from fresh eyes and identify, it's almost like injecting blue dye to allow you to be able to see those trains of thoughts,
point.
You know? And so I think that the History of Ideas program uniquely equips students to be able to identify those things. I think another benefit that I would say that I really received from it was it taught me how to deal with a text, which is something that you don't see very often, that we don't deal with text very often in our culture. We like bullet points. We like.
Now you're talking about opposable thumbs on my iPhone, that kind of text, right?
Exactly. And so knowing what you do when you have a big, scary book with lots of big words, how do you start to march around it? How do you start to, you know, attack it? How do you digest it? And that is just a skill that I've seen has helped me in my years after college that I think really helps whether you're going to be a lawyer or you're going to be a doctor, you're going to be a pastor, doesn't matter what you're doing. That skill is very, very valuable.
Yeah. Well, and today's world, especially here in America, where as you come back and you start to apply this kind of training with the history of ideas and philosophy, what does America look like to you from that academic perspective? Because I think most of us think, well, it's just kind of America. But America is a vast tapestry with all kinds of different colors. Mm-hmm. And I'm not talking about skin colors. I'm talking about different ways of thinking, different ways of approaching reality. And is it pretty broad from that perspective now that you've been down this road for so many years as you look at our America?
Well, I would say after coming back from America from overseas, you definitely see things that are distinctly American. And that's definitely real. In the midst of all the differences, there are things that, you know, only an American would say or only an American would think. However, I think there's this great post-structuralistic philosopher named Foucault who talks about how we have these ideas that become naturalized. And essentially what that means is they become camouflaged against the backdrop of our world. We don't see them. We don't recognize that we have them, but we carry them around without even understanding it.
Yeah.
And the importance of being able to actually identify them.
Yeah, and could we use the world? Could we use the phrase worldview there?
Absolutely.
Yeah, we're going to unpack that when we come back. What do we see as we look across the American landscape? What do we see in the halls of governance, or even in the media, in academics, in the schools that you send your kids to? This is a very, very important topic. We'll get into some specifics, and it's probably going to be like, oh, you're going to have a few of those moments. We're here with Amber Bowen. This is Steve Noble on Call to Action. We'll be right back.
This is where I say I don't need to have control. This is where I admit.
Welcome back. It's Steve Noble, Call to Action Radio here at Southeastern Baptist Theological Seminary. Of course, every week, Theology Thursday with our good friends here at not only the seminary, but also the college at Southeastern. And Amber Bowen is a new teacher at the college at Southeastern teaching the history of ideas. We're unpacking that today, which is something you go, oh, well, that's, you know, I don't even know what you're talking about. Well, you're about to as we kind of start to unpack this with Amber as she leads us down this road. And then you're going to see that this actually is all over the place. Even if you're watching God help you, the DNC convention tonight, you're going to see different ideas and different philosophies that have been around for a while showing up in what people say, even how they act. It impacts the political world, media, culture, the arts, everything. It's all over the place. And when we finished up the last segment, Amber, I used the word worldview, which I think a lot of people, we've talked about that for about 15, 20 years now in Christendom here in America. A worldview, the lens through which you see everything, which involves all these presuppositions about who is man, who is God, what is true. What's the nature of mankind, all that kind of stuff. So when we talk about the history of ideas, are we talking about, like, you know, bowling pins and light bulbs and cars? What are these ideas we're talking about?
Well, when we talk about that, we're not talking about just any idea that anybody's ever had in the history of thought.
Right.
We're talking.
That'd be a little bit longer than a semester class.
That's a little bit longer. That's longer than a degree program for sure. What we're talking about specifically are the people who are asking questions, worldview questions. What is real? What is ultimate reality? What can we know about ultimate reality? A big question that you see traced throughout all of humanity is the question, what does it mean? What does the good life mean? How do you live the good life? How do you not live the good life? What does the good life look like in society? How can you create a society that will allow us to have the good life? What does it mean in terms of morality and our ethics in order to have the good life? So there are both these sort of abstract metaphysical questions, but they're always tied and rooted and contextualized within very earthy questions about what does it mean to live and what does my existence mean?
Yeah. And so what are some of the major ideas, streams of thought that we're looking at today? And you can mention any of them from the past, but specifically we'll get into one of the ones that are showing up today in the Western culture. But just name some of them, because I think people will start going, oh, okay, I know what you mean.
Yeah, well, these are ideas that you do see every day. I'll list two, for example. There's a tension between nature versus freedom. What does that mean? How do we look at nature, and what is nature? Is it a machine that works with these natural laws and it just has this mechanistic structure to it? If that's the case, then where do we fit within that system? Are we also just parts of the machine? Do we stand outside of the machine? What does it mean if reality is a machine for us to actually have freedom? Do we have freedom? Do we want to have freedom?
Right.
All these questions that are actually part of our everyday lives, and we don't even recognize it. Another thing that's very much part of our everyday life is the idea of substance dualism. So we kind of all have this inherent belief that, you know, I have this immaterial soul and it's kind of trapped within my material body. And one day my soul's going to be free and fly and I'm going to lose the mortal flesh.
I'll go up above the table, the operating table, see myself,
exactly.
See my aunt and uncle, my parents, whatever.
Right. And what a lot of people don't realize is that answer of substance dualism, I mean, you could trace ideas back for a long ways, but really that idea of substance dualism was a direct response to the question of nature versus freedom. So what does it mean for a human being to be free, but yet be in the system of nature? Well, in order to answer that question, they kind of divided man in two and said, well, he has this immaterial part of him. He has this material part of him. And that's how we can reconcile those two things. But we have actually acquired that belief, and that's sort of the folk view. I mean, that's even when you're having discussions about transgender identity, for example. That's the ultimate belief, that you have an immaterial soul, and that immaterial soul is the bedrock of your identity. And then you have your body that's separate. Well, if that's the case, then it's logically possible that there could be incongruence between the two.
Right, right.
And if that's the case...
So my gender versus my biological sex.
Right. So
I feel this way, although I look the other way.
Well, and the more important part of that is the bedrock of my identity doesn't lie in my body. It lies in my soul, which we often see in just preferencing the immaterial over the material, the spiritual over the physical. And that is the actual discussion that's going on, even in something as real as issues of gender and sexuality. So the question being, where does the bedrock of your identity lie? Are we bifurcated, separate, dual individuals, or are we holistic? What does that mean? And these are questions that the church really has to grapple with.
Also, you're talking about worldview and things going on that we deal with daily. Would we put postmodernism in these categories of ideas?
Absolutely. And you know what? I actually I think that the church can actually greatly benefit by engaging with postmodernism, not necessarily going and trying to shoot all the ducks.
Right, because there's a lot of them.
Because there's a lot of them, but also engaging them in the sense of listening to them. Because one of the things that postmodernism does is postmodernism is all about unleashing and uncovering all of those hidden agendas, self-deception, and self-interest that lie within our structures. And they call them out. It's kind of like cough medicine for the church.
Oh, yeah,
if you
I've heard
will.
That somewhere. Yes, thank you very much for that plug.
And they so they call it out, and they allow us to see it, and they allow us to sort of self-assess, you know, our hearts, our leadership structure, our polity in our church. You know, what are these things? Where is self-interest and self-deception? Where do those things lie in the way that we think and operate every day? And so when you have people who are drawing your attention to these things, they almost function as prophets, you know, like the prophets of Israel in the Old Testament saying, hey, you guys, look, what your praise songs. Yeah, you're directing them to the one true king. But do you see your hearts when you're praising him? It's like filthy rags.
Yeah, Amos. Yeah,
like
shut up. I don't want to hear you sing another song.
Exactly. Or like Jesus, who's saying to the Pharisees, you're a bunch of whitewashed tombs because I see your systems and your structures, but let's get underneath your systems and your structures.
Yeah, fascinating. Yeah. And so do we throw world religions in here too? That's all part of it?
Absolutely.
And lack thereof, whether it's somebody that's agnostic, an atheistic worldview. Mm-hmm. You have a Middle Eastern worldview. You have Asian worldviews. You have Western or European worldviews. And, of course, in America, we have somewhat of a hybrid, but it's become Americanized. I think mm-hmm. we have a fairly unique way of life relative to the rest of the world. How does this show up in the church? Let's bring it inside of our own little house. How does it begin to show up in the church, in the Christian church, these different ideas from history,
right.
How do they show up in for us as Christians, or even in preaching and teaching and worship? Is it in everything?
Yeah, it absolutely is. I think if we looked at our lives in every areas of our lives, and especially looked inside of our church, we could dust for fingerprints of all of these different ideas that we've acquired that we don't even realize that we have acquired. And that's that whole point of having something, and what a lot of these philosophers call is an idol being something that you don't even realize is there. You don't know it exists. You
right.
don't know why you think a certain way. You just know you think a certain way. So we see it in, you know, we see it in our conception of the American dream, for example. That's just normal to us. That's the most normal thing that we've ever thought of. I mean, we don't even question it. We don't even stop and think about the ways that that is completely counter to the contrary to the gospel.
Uh-oh, now you're picking a fight.
We don't think about different our understanding of what it means to be pro-life and ways that we are actually listening more to our culture than we are to the scriptures. The ways that we engage politically, the ways that we have leadership styles in our church.
Yeah.
Tons of different ways.
Well, a couple of different scriptures I want to get to when we come back, which will help guide our conversation as what does the scripture teach us about these philosophies that are in the world? How do we interact with them? And what's going on? What's showing up in your life? What's showing up in my life? And how does that compare to the Word of God? We're talking to Amber Bowen. It is Theology Thursday out here at the college and the seminary, Southeastern Baptist. Well, this is Steve Noble, Call to Action. We'll be right back. Back at Steve Noble, Call to Action Radio, Theology Thursday with our friends at Southeastern Baptist Theological Seminary. Here's an idea for you. Don't hit yourself in the nose with your headphones when you're putting them back on. You know, after putting headphones on, probably, I don't know, Amber Bowen's here with us. She teaches the history of ideas at the College of Southeastern. And I think I've put headphones on to do radio show probably 6,000 times. And I've hit myself in the nose probably 5 times, but I just did it for your benefit. So just to prove that I'm just a big loser. The fact that I'm on the radio doesn't mean much of anything other than I've got a big mouth. But anyway, it's great to have you here, Amber. Thanks for spending some time with us on Theology Thursday. So this was an interesting idea. I appreciate you bringing this up. So if we're going to talk about the history of ideas and ideas that are affecting the church today and affect our daily lives, let's hear from some atheists with respect to us. So atheistic perspectives on the church. This is a fascinating angle. So swing away.
I think sometimes it's really good for us to actually listen to the atheists. Oftentimes we think
to
actually listen.
Yeah,
and you know, that's the thing. We hear you're atheist. I'm going to plug my ears and I'm going to attack.
Exactly. Yeah, I'm with you.
And so we're always on the defensive and we're never on the listening side of things. And so I think one of the big problems that we have is we're far, especially this day and age, we're really, really obsessed with forming our opinions of things. You know, am I on this side or am I on this side? Do I have this view or do I have this view? And we're really, really set on figuring out the rightness of the issues that we don't ever take time to actually stop and examine our own hearts. We're more busy forming our opinions than we are looking at our hearts. And so these guys, these modern atheists, I'm going to throw out some big names. Freud, Marx, Nietzsche, Camus, Derrida. Like those are, you guys should be shuddering
hardcore,
right now.
Yes, these are hardcore atheists.
These are hardcore. These are the bad guys, right, in terms of Christian worldview and things like that. But in reality, I think that these guys function for us like the prophets of the Old Testament, or even like Jesus to the Pharisees, or like Paul saying to the churches, your works are dead. Why are you having Jesus plus all your works? Or like James, who criticizes cheap grace or our practice of favoritism in the church. These people who are calling out things and they can see things that we can't because we're within it. So we benefit from actually stopping our defense and actually listening to them and examining our hearts. And so these guys, they're not all atheists are the same. there are really two big types of atheists. One is the evidentialist atheist that is like a Bertrand Russell, says there's not enough evidence for me to believe in God.
Right.
And so it's very much from a place of skepticism. The more modern guys like Marx, Nietzsche, Freud, Camus, all these other guys, they are more in the line of suspicion. They're not skeptics. They're suspicious. So they look at religion and they say, do you guys, well, they look at society and man in general, and they say, we're messed up. We are really messed up. We got mommy issues. We've got power issues. We've got structural issues. We are messed up. Nobody has a stronger understanding of original sin than these guys do. And then they say, look at our religious structures. That is just covering up all of our messed upness.
Yeah.
And so when Marx says religion is the opium of the masses, what he means by that is we're popping Tylenol to get down our fever, and we're not actually dealing with the fact that we got the flu.
Yeah.
We're treating our symptoms, and we're not looking at the disease. And so what they see, what looks like piety on the outside is just masking and covering up self-interest. It's covering up the desire for fame and glory. And don't we see that in the church today?
Absolutely, of course.
You could write the best books with the strongest content and be the most orthodox and the most theologically correct and do it from a position of a desire of fame and glory and power. And they would blow the whistle on that.
Yeah, yeah.
You could have perfect understanding and views on ethics and how Christians should live their lives and how they should dialogue to combat the false, you know, beliefs in society. And yet you're doing it from a sense of deceptive devotion. And they're going to call that out. And they're going to say, you're just spraying the masses with opium. And not actually allowing them to get to what's at the root, which we would maybe put a theological terminology on that, the root being sin.
Yeah, of course.
And so some of these guys, you know, Freud is going to look at the way that we look at nature versus nurture and these desires that we actually have that we're just kind of suppressing and covering up just in the name of looking good for society. I mean, how often do we do that in the church? Let's be honest.
No, Amber, you're so cynical.
Marx has a very good point. He says, do you want to know the health of something, a structure, whether it's a church, whether it's an institution, whether it's a political system? In order for you to understand the health of that, you need to look at the little guy. You don't need to look at the big guy. Mm-hmm. You need to look at the proletariat, not the bourgeoisie.
Right.
So you don't want to ask the big guy how the structure is, if he thinks it's good or if she thinks it's healthy, whatever it might be. You want to go to the little guy and say, no, what's your experience? And then you can actually know the system. So these guys are essentially saying our orthodoxy is great, but our orthopraxy is what validates it and what shows.
Yeah, you show me your faith by what you say, and I'll show you my faith by what I do.
Right. It's the same thing that James tells us. It's the same thing that Jesus says to the Pharisees, who had really great categories and boxes and the issues of righteousness and things like that. And he says, you guys have missed the point entirely. So if we stop combating and kind of bring down the inflammation when we hear those big, bad atheistic names,
yeah,
and we allow them to actually talk to us. Now, that doesn't mean that we believe everything they say. Doesn't even mean we believe half of what they say. But in order to enter into dialogue with somebody, you actually have to listen. And in order to dialogue as a human, you have to be a human. We're not here just combating ideas. So the history of ideas doesn't just mean my ideas are coming at your ideas like some kind
right.
of video game.
Which is
right?
how we typically live. I'm especially now in a political season.
Or
you know,
in
throwing
through
tweets
social
at each
media.
Other.
Exactly. Right. Like there are these two, the combating of ideas. We're human beings. Who have context, we have history, we have our lives. We sit down and we dialogue. And in order to do that, there has to be the ability to listen and there has to be the ability to self-examine before we actually speak. Doesn't mean we don't speak. It
right,
doesn't mean we
right,
speak.
Right, right, right. Well, the scriptures also tell us that we're to be slow to speak, slow to anger, quick to listen. And oftentimes we just are telling, well, let me just tell you what the deal is.
Exactly.
And we don't listen. And when we're not listening, nobody's going to listen to us.
Right.
And so we get nowhere.
One guy who is really, really helpful that I think a lot of Christians have heard of, his name is Soren Kierkegaard. And Kierkegaard saw his job was to actually save Christianity from Christendom. And that's what he said. he was very worried about, in his context of the day, that we had this really robust understanding of Christendom that had absolutely nothing to do with Christianity that we find in the Bible. And so that was his whole project, was pointing out all of these structures and areas in our thought that actually were not under the authority of the scriptures.
So kind of the industry of Christianity versus the essence of Christianity.
Absolutely. Or the structures that have been created.
Right, right.
But you know what? That's what we're supposed to do as the church. We're supposed to admonish and exhort one another daily, lest any of us be deceived by sin. We're supposed to be looking at our lives and examining ourselves and speaking into one another's lives from the authority of the scriptures. We're supposed to be vigilant and watching over ourselves so we take every thought captive for Christ. And the best way for us to do that is to be listening to other people who can maybe see things that we're harboring that we can't necessarily see ourselves.
So when we're studying the history of ideas as 21st century Christians here in the American context, what are some things, some takeaways that we can learn about ourselves, the way we're approaching the scriptures, the way we're approaching church, the way we're approaching each other and the outsiders from an understanding of the history of ideas and how these things have kind of flowed into modern life? What are some warning signs and some ways that we can work on this, Amber?
Well, I think some of the points that these guys bring up, these suspicious atheists bring up, are important because they say, look at the things you're passionate about and examine them and make sure that the values that you are distancing yourself from are not the values that are actually motivating you. So we're going to talk about standing up for the weak and the oppressed through, you know, that's what it means to be pro-life, is to value life because we're made in the image of God. And so what that means is that we value all of life from the womb to the tomb and not just one pocket or one portion of life.
Right.
But you know what? We can go through our entire life with a definition of what it means to be pro-life and not even think twice of it. Until we have other people who come and say, hey, let's open up your definition because you're not realizing this. You're not intending this, but your definition is far too narrow.
Yeah, because this gets thrown at the pro-life movement all the time. I've dealt with it myself time and time again over the years, is that you only care about life in the womb, inside the womb. You don't care much about life outside the womb. By the way, what are you doing when it comes to orphans and when it comes impoverished people and people that don't have a job?
Right.
And that's what we're getting on the other side, the outside of the womb. And you go, well, I don't really do anything about that. I'm just called to deal with pro-life.
Right.
To us means just like Black
just
Lives Matter.
Line.
You see this right now. Pro-life just means babies that are being murdered in the womb.
Right. Yeah. So I think it's the mistaking the part for the whole. So the part fighting for life in the womb, that is definitely a part of what it means to be pro-life. We don't want to diminish that. We don't want to take it away. We want to fight with everything we have for it. But we don't want to make the mistake of thinking that that part is the entire whole
right,
of what it
right,
means to
right.
be pro-life.
Yeah, there's a couple of those, a couple more examples of that on my mind. We'll finish up the conversation on the history ideas. Then we're going to talk about something that I know you want to talk about, which is the life of a woman in the world of the academic, in the academy, an academician. Is that right? I should run for president because I think I just made up a word. That's a sure sign that one needs to be the president. This is Steve Noble or whatever my name is on Call to Action. We'll be right back. Welcome back. It's Steve Noble. It is Call to Action Radio Theology Thursday with our friends at Southeastern Baptist Theological Seminary and the college at Southeastern. And they did not, by the way, sanction the use of Maroon 5 in this bump music. So what kind of a history of ideas problem do I have, Amber Bowen, who teaches the history of ideas at the college at Southeastern, that a guy that says he loves the Lord would
play Maroon 5?
It's playing Maroon 5 on his bump music on Christian radio around the nation. What do you say about that?
There's probably some idols underneath there that we'll have to.
Yeah, yeah. Do I idolize? What's the guy's name? What's the lead singer's name? Adam Levine.
Yeah. Don't ask me those questions.
I wish I looked like Adam Levine, maybe minus the tats. But I could. Is that? Oh, listen. Did you hear that? That was my wife saying amen. We'll move on. So we're talking about the history of ideas. I definitely want to make sure we spend a little bit of time before we run out of time talking about life. The life of a woman in the world of the academy and as in higher education, what that's like for you. But let's get to one more atheist. And somebody, Matthew Mears, a good friend of mine, a pastor, asked the question about which one of these atheists is really the most insightful as a critique against the church. Your answer off the air was, Well, Nietzsche kind of makes you the most uncomfortable.
Yeah, he does. His work, The Antichrist in particular, but a lot of his works do, where I personally found just the sting of conviction quite a bit. Because that's what he does specifically in that work, is he looks at all these different things and areas in the church, and he uncovers them. And he talks about the priests and how what the priests are doing is really controlling the people, because they're trying to stay in this position in between them and God, and therefore, in a sense, separating from God. Whereas, you know, Christ is that one who brings us together.
Yeah.
And he says, no, but what actually happens oftentimes in the church is corruption comes in, and that mediator actually functions as a blockage between the people and God. So he criticizes that. He looks at our systems of ethics and morality, and he says this has more to do with furthering the interests of a certain group of society, as opposed to actually being true. And how do we know that it's true? And obviously, he didn't have a concept of the Bible. In fact, he was critical of the Bible. But a lot of what he says about our morality and our practices in our religion,
yeah,
he's spot on.
We need to hear it.
He's absolutely spot on. So what the last thing we need to do is not read Nietzsche very carefully. I mean, when I was going through the program, someone said, saw me with carrying Nietzsche, the book. Exactly.
Turn her in.
Like, oh, but you're a Christian. Why are you reading that? And I would tell people I was getting a degree in pagan philosophy. But oftentimes the response to me was, don't read that stuff too carefully. I mean, especially when I was carrying around the Communist Manifesto. You know, don't read that too carefully.
Hello.
Whereas actually, I think we need to read it very, very carefully.
Absolutely.
So one of the Nietzsche quote that everybody knows is God is dead. And he makes this proclamation, God is dead. And as soon as Christians hear that, that's what they associate with Nietzsche. And they think, oh, my goodness, he's evil. We can't listen to him. But what Nietzsche actually means by that is God is dead because the God that we worship, the God that you worship, is actually a God that you have created in your own image. He's a God that you have exalted, and you don't even realize you've exalted him. And you created him, and you're following him, and you're worshiping him. He's dead because he doesn't exist, because you created him. And that's what Nietzsche was actually saying there. He wasn't just saying, haha, I killed God, which most people think is, you know, they're like,
sure,
he's absurd, he's nuts, he's out of his mind. But that's what he was actually saying. He's got a point, American Christians, because how often is the God that we worship more similar to a tribal deity,
right? Yeah,
who's going to bless us, you know,
right,
when we offer the appropriate sacrifice?
Sure. Yeah, oh, you hear it in our praise music.
You absolutely do.
You know,
if we
hey,
suffer,
Lord, you are so in love with me. You know, I'm like so awesome. You like just were dying to get to the cross because you just had to have a relationship with me,
right? Well, and if we suffer, we go through struggles, or we go through times
right,
not of prosperity, it must mean that we're not doing the right sacrifices to our tribal deity.
Right.
And so in that sense, God, we've created that God in our own image. And you know what? That God is dead because he's not the one true God.
Yeah, that's not him.
That's not him. So that's Nietzsche. And that's why I think he's important for us to listen to.
Yeah, what a great point. So for college education, the college at Southeastern, obviously a great gem here in Wake Forest, North Carolina. And all the mm-hmm. links are at the website, as always, and on the email every day, sebts.edu. What's the website address for the college?
College at Southeastern.
The college at Southeastern.edu.
Mm-hmm.
There's that one. So let's hit one other one, and this will take us right into our conversation on what it's like to be a highly intelligent woman in the world of academics. But just our understanding of men and women, manhood, womanhood. We touched about on Tuesday with another professor from the King's College up in New York when we were talking about transgenderism and homosexuality. But the history of ideas in Western thought versus what we're doing with men and women in the church. Speak to that real quick, and then we'll talk about your life in the world of academics.
Hmm. Well, one of the things that I'm really curious about is if I could be in a dialogue with some of these guys, with the Marx and Nietzsche and Freud. Now, Marx did talk about this a little bit with these guys, and I specifically asked them to look at our concepts within the evangelical church of biblical manhood and womanhood. I'm just really curious to know what they would say. I mean, what would they think? How would they respond to it? What would they say? And so that's one of the things that I think is important for the church to do, because we have something much better than Nietzsche, Freud, and Marx. Far better. We have the Word of God. But we can take their example of examining things that we just presuppose and examining them under the light of the Scriptures. So what are, and these are just kind of broad questions for us to wrestle with, what are some of those connotations of masculinity or femininity that don't come from the Scriptures, but we've kind of assumed that they do because we've just acquired them, almost like one of those robot vacuum cleaners that just goes around the room and it acquires all of this stuff. What are those ideas of those things, or you know, what men are supposed to do versus what women are supposed to do, or how they're supposed to act, or how they're supposed to talk, or education that they're supposed to have or they're not supposed to have, or jobs, or whatever it might be. What are those things that are extra acquired junk that are not found within the scriptures?
Is there one in particular, Amber, in your life experience that really gets under your nails? To feminize my question.
Well, I think, jumping into the women in academia issue, in the evangelical world, there's not a ton of women in academia. And so that is one of the things that I've been so encouraged by Southeastern in my time here, is because we have a place that is really seeing the need for women in academia, but on a broader scale, understanding every day that I come here that theological education is important, and it's really important for women, and it's to the benefit of the church to have theologically robust women. And that doesn't matter if you're going to be a wife and a mom, if you're going to be the CEO of a huge corporation, yeah. If you're going to be a doctor, whatever it might be. It is to the benefit of the church to have theologically robust mothers and wives. It is to the benefit of the church to have.
And we often think that's man's work.
We do.
Because we have, you know, the scriptures take us down a road where there is a structure. There are different roles, and roles has nothing to do with a value. It's not a value statement.
Right.
It's just a role statement. But I totally see that people are like, why would your daughter go get a PhD? And that, why, you know, that's like a man's world. Yeah. There's a friend of mine on Facebook. She runs something, womeninapologetics.com. Brilliant. Sarah Renee is her name. Just brilliant. And she's had a really difficult time.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, just finding robust employment and stuff. Because people go, a woman expert in apologetics?
Yeah.
Well, that can't possibly be.
Yeah,
which is ridiculous.
It's like there's an inherent suspicion when that happens. Whereas in reality, and that's ultimately rooted in an undetected idea that says, you know, women are not supposed to be as theologically robust as for men, or we think that somehow that's going to deter us from that role of helpmeet or helper. And I think a wrong understanding of what helpmeet means or what submission means, or, you know, and so I think we can more effectively, you know, my mentor and like a mother figure to me says all the time, it's godly women that make the best wives. Godly women that make the best CEOs, the best teachers, the best whatever it might be. And so we want to, you know, be committed in our churches to formulate. We want our women's ministry to be feeding the women steak, not milk.
Yeah.
We want them to be in the word. We don't want to lighten anything for them. They're not getting scraps. They're not getting accommodations or anything like that. We want to drop it.
Yeah.
We want them in the word. And that is going to be to the benefit of their families. That's going to be to the benefit of their schools or wherever they might be. That's not going to take away from that. That's actually going to help.
Well, interestingly enough, inside the church itself, look at the world of homeschooling, which my wife and I have been a part of for 13 or 14 years now. You know, women are carrying the lion's share of the responsibility.
Right.
But then we think that they shouldn't have the utmost in theological training and have those chops. We're shooting ourselves in the foot.
If you're a homeschool mom, you need to be theologically beefy. You need to be.
What a great point.
You really do, because you're forming young minds. You're forming the next generation. You're forming your sons and your daughters, and you're sending them out to the various places that they're going to go. And even when we're raising our daughters, you know, I think a great thing is recognizing that the body is, we use the word body because it's made up of different parts and not all of us are the same. And one great thing about Southeastern is it recognizes that it's not a factory of elbow joints. You know,
right.
It's not a factory trying to create the same body part and send them out. It's not a franchise system. It's nothing like that. But it's a group of professors. And my experience here has just been professors who look at the students. They see how they're uniquely gifted and they pour into that, into equipping that. And that's the same for men and women with different giftings on a broad spectrum. And that's how we equip ourselves to fulfill the Great Commission.
Two requests lastly, as we finish up. Just number one, an encouragement to the young women out there in terms of pursuing theological excellence.
Yes.
What do you say to them?
Do it. Find other women who are interested in these things. Form book clubs. Read. There's great material out there. Go for it.
And let me drop this one on you. Number one book for somebody that's interested in beginning to study the history of ideas.
Oh my goodness, that's really terrible. How about we tweet that out later?
All right, I'm going to put that up on Facebook in 5 minutes when you come up with the answer, and then yes. We'll put it on Twitter or put it up on c2atoday.com. The College at Southeastern, that's college@southeastern.com. Of course, Southeastern Baptist Theological Seminary, sebts.edu. Amber Bowen, what a pleasure it was having you on today. Thanks for being here to help us out.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Okay, friends, God willing, I'll be in here again tomorrow, and I'll talk to you then.